fighting to stay today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Kelly is a 25-year-old immigrant who could potentially be deported by the Trump administration, but she says she's not going quietly.
Next steps is to continue fighting, continue to be an activist, and continue to let the administration know that I'm here and that I'm ready to take on anything.
Also, what's next after President Trump officially withdraws the U.S. from the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement?
A lot of people who were in favor of the TPP say Trump has given control, ceded control to China, and that China can take the lead in writing the global rules of trade in that part of the world.
Plus, what happens when German writers decide to form a soccer team?
I think soccer is a game that is essentially about failure and emptiness.
That's all ahead today on The World. Thanks for being with us on this Monday. First full business day on the job for President Trump, and already big changes. We'll dig into three of them today, what the changes seem to mean for the press, and in a moment, is the Trans-Pacific Partnership really over as of today? But first, to a promise Trump said he'd keep from day one, eliminating DACA. That's Obama's program that offers temporary legal status to people who were brought into the country illegally as children. Deferred action for childhood arrivals. Some 750,000 young immigrants are covered by DACA. Kelly is a 25-year-old whose family brought her to the U.S. from Peru as a child. She's protected from deportation by DACA. When we spoke with her right after the election, she asked that we use just her first name. She was worried about how people around her might treat her. Kelly joins us now again. Do you still feel that way, Kelly?
No, actually, after thinking about it and seeing a lot of people coming out and sharing their stories and a lot of support, I feel like giving my complete name and face to the problem actually brings awareness. So I feel completely different now.
Well, we can't see you on radio, but what is your full name, Kelly?
Kelly Izike.
Kelly Izike. So does it feel kind of liberating to come out and say, I am who I am?
It's like a weight off your shoulders, and it lets you tell a better story without having to lie constantly or make up things.
So tell us a bit of your story. What has DACA enabled you to do?
Well, when DACA was introduced, I was a senior in college, and so I was really worried about what to do with my degree. So as soon as it was introduced, I was actually able to get a job. It was just a retail job. But then I was also able to get an internship at the UN, at the United Nations. Mm. It was an unpaid internship, but that went on to leading to more opportunities. And now I currently work for a nonprofit organization that seeks to help women internationally and protect women's rights.
So you've had all this life, work, education experience here in the U.S. If DACA was suddenly eliminated, you would have no more protection?
Yes. Basically, I wouldn't be able to work legally anymore.
So just describe kind of what you've been thinking, what you've been feeling as the new president takes office.
I've been overwhelmed with a lot of emotions. At first, I was very scared, especially while the transition was happening. But now I feel a lot more powerful. And even though there is this threat, this looming threat, I feel like especially I need to just remain calm and seek other ways and try to just tell my story and try to make people understand that we're not here, you know, to mooch off government assistance, that we're really here to try to be part of the society. And a lot of us have accomplished that, and we've entered the workforce within 4 years and have contributed so much already.
Is your own family a mix of people who are undocumented and others who are U.S. citizens? And how's all of this playing out in your immediate family?
Yes. So my immediate family is made up of U.S. citizens, permanent residents, and undocumented. We are very close with one another. And there's also guilt because some of them are like able to not have to worry about this every day.
Are they feeling
guilty?
Hard.
Yeah. Like I feel like they do, especially like my parents. I feel like they feel a little bit guilty because they are permanent residents now. So, yeah,
your parents are permanent residents.
Yes, they are.
But you're still covered under DACA. So it's
yes.
Conceivable that you could be deported while your parents would be able to stay.
Yes, correct.
How does that make you feel? That must be really weird.
Yeah, it makes me feel a lot of emotions, even though there is that weird emotion of, okay, we might be able to stay and you might have to go. We're still very close to one another and we support one another no matter what.
Kelly, I don't know if you were watching, but yesterday on Fox News Sunday, White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus talked about DACA. Let's just hear what he had to say real quick.
Mm-hmm. I think we're going to work with House and Senate leadership as well to get a long-term solution on that issue. But
so we're going to do DACA until
I'm not going to make any commitments today, but I obviously foreshadowed there a little bit.
All right. So, Kelly, what do you make of that? Did it feel to you like Priebus was saying Trump is going to undo DACA?
So it's a little bit disconcerting to kind of hear them saying that they don't want to give comments on something that he has been promising from day one.
Yeah. So what are your immediate plans, Kelly?
So my immediate plans, if it does happen to be revoked, is just to have a conversation with my employer and also have a conversation with my family and see what we can do together, and also just create networks and connect with people and share our stories and continue fighting. Even if, you know, I'm not able to work legally, I'll continue to let the administration know that I'm here and that I'm ready to take on anything.
Kelly Ezeke lives and works in New York City and is protected from deportation by DACA. President Trump wasted no time in following through on one of his big promises today. He signed an executive order rejecting the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. This would have been Obama's signature legacy on trade, covering 12 nations that account for 40% of the global economy. Trump now has his sights on remaking NAFTA, the trade agreement between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. The World's Jason Margolis joins me. You've been reporting on these deals for a long time, Jason. What does today's news on the TPP mean?
Well, the news today isn't entirely unexpected. Trump said he was going to do this, and he did.
So if there's no TPP, what's next?
That's the question. I mean, nobody knows. With a lot of Trump's policies, he's been vague, right? A lot of people who were in favor of the TPP say Trump has given control, ceded control to China, and that these countries along the Asia-Pacific Rim, Japan, Vietnam, Australia, now they can sign trade agreements with China, and China can take the lead in writing the global rules of trade in that part of the world. We'll see.
Generally, Trump has not really favored trade deals. He's turning to NAFTA next, the North American Free Trade Agreement. He says he'll renegotiate it. What can he actually do to NAFTA?
These are all good questions for which nobody has good answers. So it's a treaty. He can't just renegotiate it on his own. He has to have the approval of Congress and then Mexico and Canada. Trump likes to say, we're going to get it done. We're going to get it done quickly. It's not possible.
During the campaign, Trump seemed to equate deals like NAFTA with the reason a lot of people lost their jobs in the United States. Is that why people hate NAFTA so much? And what's the reality check on that? Do they hate it?
Yes, they hate it. I've spent a lot of time in the industrial Midwest. They blame the demise of their towns on NAFTA. But what is the reality? Okay, so there's some studies that say NAFTA may have cost the United States 700,000 jobs. That's on the high end. Some studies say it costs the United States no jobs. So how can there be such a disparity?
Right.
Because how do you blame a job that left Michigan? Did it go away because of greater automation? Did it go to Mexico? Did it go to China? Did it just disappear? You can't just say this job left because of NAFTA.
Right. A lot of dynamics at play there. So what's been the reaction from Mexico and Canada, the two other signatories to NAFTA, and these kind of threats that it's going to get renegotiated or go away?
Right. So Mexico's President Enrique Peña Nieto today said that any new trade deals that Mexico signs need to improve wages for Mexican workers. And that's fair. I was just on the phone with an economist in Mexico City, and she's saying, look, it's not like all these jobs have come down to Mexico and we're all rich all of a sudden. These are low-wage jobs, you know, people earning $2-3 an hour. Up in Canada, there's concern, trepidation, worry, but they haven't said definitively what they'll do if Trump tries to renegotiate the deal.
And Jason, just to reiterate, these anti-trade positions that Trump is taking, these are basically populist positions that go against Trump's own GOP party, right?
Right. The Republican leaders favor more free trade. I mean, Paul Ryan was working very closely with President Obama to get the TPP done. What no one can figure out is how is Trump going to renegotiate these trade deals when his own party favors more trade. It really goes to what Trump is, right? He's a chaos candidate, and now he's proving to be a chaos president. He's just blowing everything up. I mean, in the past, up until this year, if you were a Democrat or you're a Republican, you work within the system to advance your own goals. And Trump is saying, I'm just going to blow it all up. And that's what a lot of people wanted, in fairness. You know, a lot of people who didn't see the spoils of NAFTA and these trade deals and globalization, they said, blow it up because it's not working for me.
The World's Jason Margolis. Thanks.
You're welcome.
This past weekend, more than 1 million people worldwide took to the streets to protest Donald Trump's inauguration. Some estimates even triple that number. But now what? How do you turn marches into a movement? And is that what the marchers want? The world's ISIS Madrid was at the march in D.C. over the weekend. She spoke with protesters and organizers. ISIS, would the organizers say they want a movement to come out of all the marches? And what are the next steps?
Yes, they definitely want this to become a movement. I spoke to Linda Sarsour. She's the executive editor of the Arab American Association in New York, and she's one of the co-chairs of the march. She told me that things are already happening.
There is going to be a group of 500 women who are being trained to run for office. There's going to be teach-ins on different issues around climate justice, around racial justice happening just around the D.C. area. But to your point, it matters to me more what happens after the march. And what we hope happens is that people are so inspired, so moved, that they go back to their local communities and find causes to be a part of.
So the march organizers also put together this action plan called 10 Actions for the First 100 Days. They put the first one out yesterday, and they're asking people who marched or people who wish they had marched to write a postcard to their senators about what issues matter most to them. And they're also encouraging marchers to, as Linda said, gather in their communities, do this together, write the postcards over drinks and dinner, talk about what matters, and kind of spark change in their own communities.
So the marches were on Saturday, but the organizers are clearly not standing still. Was the march over the weekend different from marches you've covered in the past?
At least in Washington, which is where I was, it was very diverse, very inclusive. I saw white women chanting Black Lives Matter. I saw men wearing T-shirts covered in the names of female family members and friends that they were marching in the name of. I saw Arab women holding up signs for indigenous rights. It was truly a show of solidarity.
So that's impressive. But inclusivity, could it be a problem going forward? Because many famous marches in the past have focused on one goal, opposing the Vietnam War, opposing the war in Iraq. But the stated platform online for the Women's March in Washington and all the sister marches was pretty all-encompassing. Reproductive rights, women rights, equal human rights, equal pay for equal work, even environmental justice. Is that going to be an issue for turning this into a cohesive social movement?
Well, it's complicated, Marco. On the one hand, you can argue that these movements are stronger together. If my sisters rise, I rise. You know, those were the kinds of signs that I saw and the chants that I heard. But on the other hand, inclusivity and intersectionality, the whole idea is these intersections of oppression, intersections of obstacles that women are facing. There's race, there's gender, there's climate change in your community, poverty, disabilities. And there's going to be friction when those intersections connect. And moving forward together as a group is going to be difficult. There will be growing pains. We'll see what happens.
But it sounds like Linda Sarsour is saying, bring it on, we can do this together.
Yes, she definitely is.
The world's ISIS Madrid, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
You're with the world. President Trump inherits a lot of foreign policy challenges, especially in the Middle East, where ISIS still has plenty of muscle. In northern Iraq, a government push to reclaim the city of Mosul is now grinding into its fourth month. Tens of thousands of people have been displaced by the fighting. And remember, that displacement comes after the trauma of living under ISIS rule for 2 years. Late last year, our correspondent Richard Hall visited the area to meet people caught up in the fighting. We'll be bringing you their stories all this week. We start off today with Richard's story of Zakra Yunus and her daughter, Huda.
I'm walking around a huge camp for displaced people from Mosul when I come across Zakra Yunus. She's standing in a long queue, waiting to collect water with a group of women who had recently escaped the city, like her. The horrors of the fighting are fresh in their minds.
How can I explain it to you? It was a genocide. There were bombs every half hour by ISIS. We left between the bullets and snipers. We survived by some divine power.
Zakra invites me into her tent. There are just a few thin mattresses and a small cooking stove. It's been a little over a week since she fled Mosul with her six children, after 2 years of living under the rule of the Islamic State. They all come into the tent and gather around us while Zakra gets ready to tell me her story. Zakra is 43 years old and has a calm and confident air. She wants to tell me all about the Mosul she knew when she was growing up.
It was beautiful, safe and calm. There were Kurds and Christians. We were all brothers and sisters. There was no difference between us.
As a young girl, Zakra was independently minded. She grew up in a conservative Sunni Muslim society where the idea of how women should live is largely dictated by religious tradition. But she wanted to find her own way.
I was raised differently. I have ambitions. When I was 14 years old, I was already driving a trailer truck. I wasn't just a normal girl or woman. I'm smarter than that. I always liked my character, my freedom, and my independence.
A mischievous smile flashes across her face here. The sight of a young Zakra driving a pickup truck around her neighborhood in Mosul must have been something to behold. But I can see it. Zakra was 23 when she married. Her husband was a mechanic. The next period of her life followed a familiar script for women in her position. She had her first child 3 years later, Huda, a bright spark who clearly has a close relationship with her mother. Now 16, Huda has lived just 3 years of her life without any war. Over the next 6 years, Zakra had 5 more children. That kept her busy. But that drive and ambition she had as a young woman never left her. After she had her last child, she decided she wanted more from life.
When I married Huda's father, he was someone that was very traditional. He was a little ignorant. He didn't give me my freedom. Every time I tried to get a job, my husband would object. I had ambitions to work. I used to always say that I didn't want to sit between four walls.
Zakra was expected to stay at home and be a housewife, but she was strong-willed. She decided that she would look for work anyway. She was 40 years old. She had had enough of men telling her what to do.
I went to apply to a local radio station. They heard my voice and then tested me. The director of the station said that my voice was beautiful.
Zakra spent a few months working as a radio journalist. She reported on the traffic, religious holidays, and local goings-on about town. I asked her if she had any tape of her reporting so I could hear her radio voice. But, much like everyone else in this camp, when she escaped Mosul, she brought only the clothes on her back. In the summer of 2014, the Islamic State overran Mosul, putting an end to Zakra's short-lived dream job. When she talks about it now, there's a bitterness there.
I couldn't go to work anymore. They took the radio and TV stations. Everything. They were later saying that journalists were going to be killed.
The next 2 years of Zakra's life were miserable.
Before, we were living in freedom. We had hope in life. It was nice. We would wear whatever we wanted. We would come and go as we pleased. When ISIS came, our lives changed. It kept going from bad to worse.
Their life was put on hold, but Zakra didn't want to stand still anymore. She urged her husband to let them escape Mosul.
I tried, but my husband didn't want to. He would say that they will eventually leave. We didn't think that they were going to stay for 2 years, honestly. Can you live without your freedom? I'm asking you this question. Can you? Would you like to be under the control of someone who knows no mercy or values or morals? Can you live under such a person?
When they finally made it out, and to the camp where I now sit with Zakra and her children, she and her husband found themselves at another impasse. He wanted to go back to Mosul. He said the neighborhood was calm now, but Zakra didn't want to go back, so she made a very difficult choice.
My husband and I are not compatible, and we both agree on that. So I told him that I stayed with you all these years, 19 years together. I told him I always do as you please, but you've got us to a very bad point.
Divorce is somewhat frowned upon in Mosul, but she wasn't in Mosul anymore. They decided to part. For Zakra, this felt like a second liberation. It was as if all the chaos and death and heartbreak that ISIS brought with them had provided her this opportunity to break free. And it wasn't just for her. She looks adoringly at Huda, her eldest daughter.
To me, my daughter is not just my daughter. She's also my friend. She's everything. Of course our lives will be different. When I was young, everything was offered to me. But she didn't have that. She didn't live a life. I want her to accomplish her ambitions. I need to be there for her where no one was there for me.
Zakra and her children are living day by day now in the camp. Huda seems to have inherited her mother's optimism. She wants to be a teacher. But it struck me that one of the great ironies of Zakra's situation is that despite all her sacrifices, Huda probably won't have the same opportunities as a mother. For Zakra and Huda, the passage of time has not brought progress. Huda will have to be much tougher than her mother was, which will be quite a feat. I asked Zakra what she would do with her new freedom.
I want to continue in radio. I want to continue what I started.
And what would you report on? I asked her.
I would talk about the suffering of the displaced people. They have nothing in this cold. No heat, no clean water. These tents are not made for people to live in, honestly. It's too cold at night, and in the summer, I'm sure the sun would strike too hard. That would be the story I would tell.
For the World, Richard Hall in Gaza, Iraq.
You can see pictures of Zakra and Huda at PRI.org. We've also got lots more information about how women live in Iraq. And remember, all week we'll be following the stories of young Iraqis and how their lives have been changed by ISIS. Tomorrow, the story of a 30-year-old English teacher named Riyad from a town just outside Mosul. He remembers the day ISIS, or Daesh, came looking for his father, a colonel in the Iraqi army.
And I hear the door cracking, and I wake up and I found the house was filled with Daesh members carrying weapons, M16, AK-47, surrounding me and shout at me, "Sit down, where is your father, who are you?"
How an English teacher in northern Iraq survived 2.5 years of ISIS rule. That story tomorrow on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, a Russian journalist has some tips for American reporters dealing with alternative facts, and political cartoonist Lalo Alcaraz has some thoughts on that, too.
In this time of alternate facts, this era of alternate facts and reality, we have to be blunt with the truth and show it.
That's ahead, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. I think it's fair to say that facts took a beating during President Trump's first few days on the job. There were the claims and counterclaims about the size of the Inauguration Day crowd and whether it rained or not when Trump spoke. On Saturday, the president praised the intelligence agencies in Washington just days after comparing their work to Nazi Germany. There were attacks on the media, and somewhere along the line, falsehoods got relabeled alternative facts. Trump spokesman Sean Spicer seemed to double down on that during his first press briefing today. When asked about the dust-up over inauguration numbers, he said,
"I believe that we have to be honest with the American people. I think sometimes we can disagree with the facts."
Disagree with the facts. That's the kind of thing that sounds all too familiar to Russian journalists like Alexei Kovalev, so he wrote a blog post about it.
There are some lessons to be learned from the experience of those who have been covering Putin's press conferences and statements over the years, because I can see a lot of similarities made by Trump and his team. But the thing is that Putin and his team and his aides and his spokespeople are quite the experts at completely dominating and controlling the agenda.
Can you give us an example of that, like at a Vladimir Putin press conference?
Well, the first thing you need to know about Putin's press conferences is that they are not designed to inform either the public or the media, because no major policy announcement ever get made at those conferences. It's all just a four-hour, one-man show. It's a deliberate strategy.
And as far as the idea that facts don't matter to Putin, at some point, facts have to mean something. I mean, 1 + 1 will always equal 2. And what do facts mean in Putin's Russia?
You see, the thing is that when you think it's your mission to make him admit a lie or an inconsistency in his previous statements, because he tends to make these U-turns in his statements or policies, when you're trying to point out those inconsistencies or catch him red-handed lying, there's no point, because he'll evade your question. He knows this, that he can just drown you in meaningless factoids or false moral equivalencies or what is called whataboutism. So, for example, when I challenged him...
Whataboutism?
Whataboutism. It's a reference to an old Soviet joke. For example, when I asked Putin, Vladimir Vladimirovich, as it is traditional to address him by his name and patronymic, So what about this stage trial resulting in human rights abuses? Why do these things happen in our country?
For example,
so
yeah.
His typical answer will be, but don't human rights abuses happen in other countries as well? What about Guantanamo, he'll say. So this is where, why, what about it?
Right.
So he'll try to dilute the seriousness of allegations by comparing them to other seemingly similar events in other countries.
So what's your advice to U.S. media?
For one thing, the American media has a distinct advantage over the Russian colleagues.
What's that?
You can meaningfully influence the public opinion so as to unseat Trump in the next election cycle. We don't have the kind of privilege because that's not how elections work in Russia. And this is what I'm seeing more and more these days. I can see that the headlines are still dominated by a statement that Trump's spokesman did on Saturday during his first ever briefing with Trump's first day in the office, Sean Spicer. And people are still completely obsessing over it and still dominating the headlines. And that's exactly the point, to keep you distracted.
Spicer's amping up the numbers at the inauguration.
Yeah, and it's just the chaff that's thrown out to distract you from things that really matter, because they want you to concentrate on things they say, not the things they do or do not say.
What would you suggest to Americans about how to react to a Trump presidency?
For one thing, don't overreact. I don't have a specific advice to all Americans because I have no experience of living in the States. But to my American colleagues, I like to say that remember that you have this advantage of being able to influence public policy, so do. Because the people at some point will stop caring, because this is also a deliberate tactic, putting out so much obvious lies that at some point the public will begin to wonder whether objective truth exists at all. They will just stop caring like they did in Russia. So don't concentrate, don't obsess yourself too much with this nonsensical factually untrue statements.
Yeah, I would suspect you would concede with the notion that the United States is not Vladimir Putin's Russia. I mean, there are some pretty troubling things happening right now, but it's not like an authoritarian regime has popped up overnight, correct?
Yes, that's true. But still, there are some troubling tendencies I see.
What's the most troubling for you right now?
Okay, there are ways to completely dominate the agenda like Putin does, but without resorting to violence or outright authoritarianism. Like I said, you can always keep the press and the public on the back foot, distracting them with these outrageous statements. And in the meanwhile, while you're distracted with these public statements, passing bills quietly that will go unreported because everybody else is busy debating whether we should cover it or not. Just concentrate on the acts, not words.
Journalist Alexei Kovalev in Moscow. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And since we're on the subject of Russia, we've got a question for President Trump, and we're asking him directly on his favorite online platform, Twitter. The question is this: how will you treat any associates currently under investigation shown to have improper ties to Russia? And listeners, you can help us by also tweeting that question to the president. Use the hashtag 100days100Qs, as in the letter Q. Yep, like the hashtag says, for the next 100 days, we'll be firing 100 questions at the president via Twitter. If you have a question you think we should ask Trump, tweet it to us at PRI The World, again using the hashtag 100days100Qs. We hope he'll answer, but like Alexei Kovalev said a minute ago, it's actions that really count. We'll be watching those too. The United States wasn't the only country coming to grips with a political transition this weekend. The tiny West African nation of the Gambia also saw a big change. President Yahya Jammeh had ruled the Gambia since he seized power in a military coup back in 1994. But over the weekend, soldiers from a coalition of neighboring countries forced him out. The coalition said they had to intervene to enforce the election results last month in the Gambia. Jammeh lost that election, then refused to leave office. But now he's cut a deal and has gone into exile. My BBC colleague Thomas Fessy is in the Gambian capital, Banjul. How are Gambians reacting to Jammeh's departure, Thomas?
Well, I think that people are mostly happy here to be able to get back to their daily businesses. Remember that last week we've seen 3 days of total shutdown. Shops, gas stations, banks, market stores, everything shut down for 3 days. So people are quite happy to be able to get back to their daily businesses. And there's a general sense of relief that Mr. Jammeh has gone. There are great hopes for the near future, as the new administration has promised a lot of change.
Meantime, there are all these foreign troops from Senegal, Nigeria, and elsewhere across the continent. How many are there in Banjul, and are Gambians happy to have them?
Well, there were 7,000 troops that were announced on standby by the West African states, as you said, from Nigeria, mainly Senegal and Ghana. But we understand that those who have crossed into the country are only the Senegalese troops who we saw arriving yesterday, actually, to the cheers of jubilating crowds around the President's State House in the capital. So they're mostly welcome. People are happy to see them here because they're aware there's a sort of power vacuum right now with the president still in neighboring Senegal. And these Senegalese troops have been tasked with securing the State House, securing the capital, and securing the rest of the country ahead of his return to sort of clear the path before he comes back.
So that's the incoming president, Adama Barrow. Yahya Jammeh was kind of holding out for a deal. He's gone into exile now. Do we know what kind of deal he actually got?
We don't exactly know the terms of the deal. There was a declaration that was issued by the African Union, the United Nations, and the ECOWAS that basically said that they would work towards guaranteeing his and his cabinet members and his family, his dignity, security and rights. They also said that any property that was lawfully acquired should be protected and that he should be free from intimidation. Now, of course, he has departed and it's not clear whether an actual deal was made. The Senegalese foreign minister went on to say that there was certainly no agreement within ECOWAS, the original West African bloc, to grant him amnesty. So that's something that's not very clear for now.
So how much money has Yahya Jammeh actually gotten away with?
So earlier today, the president's special advisor in Senegal said that the Gambia was in financial distress and that the coffers were virtually empty. And he said one of the reasons is that Mr. Jammeh had made off with more than $11 million in the last 2 weeks alone. Now, today, this afternoon, rather, the spokesman for the president here in Banjul actually denied that. So it's actually quite hard to know who to believe at the moment. So I think a lot of Gambian people will be asking for further investigation in these claims. We know for sure that three luxury cars were flown out of the country the night that Mr. Jammeh left. Another 10 were attempted to be loaded in a cargo plane, but that was prevented from the authorities here. So all that will be investigated in the days to come, I think.
Alternative facts all over the planet. My BBC colleague Thomas Fessy in the Gambian capital, Banjul. Thank you very much.
Sure. Have a good day.
Germans are known the world over for their unusually long words. They're also known as huge soccer fans. So here's a word for you. Autorennationalmannschaft. Autonama for short. It means the author's national team, as in writers who also like to play soccer. The world's Daniel Gross recently attended an Autonama practice in Berlin.
Growing up, Wolfram Eilenberger was like a lot of German teenagers. He dreamed of playing soccer professionally. Until one fateful day, when he realized,
I'm not good enough. I won't make it. And there's a great emptiness that haunts you when you're 17 or 18.
Eilenberger is 44 now, but he still remembers that sense of loss.
And then this is where actually literature and philosophy saved me.
As a young man, Eilenberger replaced soccer with books. He got a PhD and became editor of Germany's largest philosophy magazine. Only in recent years did books lead him back to soccer.
Come on! Do it!
Every Monday evening, around 20 writers gather here, on a soccer pitch in the heart of Berlin. This is Germany's author's national team. Eilenberger likes to wax poetic about the team, the way that only a philosopher would.
I think soccer is a game that is essentially about failure and emptiness.
What he means is that soccer players try to control the ball with their feet, but most of the time they end up losing control.
So it basically tells us something about the joy of losing control. And the very fact that life is failure and that your everyday existence is failure is somehow symbolized by the soccer experience.
Ever the optimist.
No, I mean, then again...
Most of Eilenberger's teammates see things a little less philosophically. Florian Werner comes here to escape his work.
writing is a very lonesome activity, and you're sitting at your desk and you're struggling against yourself. And then on Monday nights, you know, we can come here and you can let that all go. People are screaming, they're shouting, and it's a good thing, you know, to let your hair down. And
you're bald, so that's a nice comment.
Well, thank you. Yes, indeed, that's my utopia, you know, that I, even though I'm bald, once a week I let my hair down.
Werner is 46 and plays defense for Autonama. By day, he writes nonfiction.
Like, I've written one book about the cultural history of cows, another one about human excrement, and one about snails.
Autonama got started 12 years ago when a playwright named Thomas Brussig received an invitation to play in a tournament against writers in Italy. Brussig wrote to a few German writer friends, and that is how Andreas Merkel joined the team.
It was like a dream come true. It's, I think, the dream of every German child soccer player to play once in a German national dress and hear the anthem and play in a stadium and play for Germany, and was a big deal. Big fun.
The first Autonama practice was held on an improvised soccer field in eastern Germany.
Our first guy got hurt after 5 seconds of training and broke his arm. Got stuck in a hole and broke his arm. It was a nice incident.
You're laughing about that now, but in the moment that must have been awful.
No, it was a big laugh for all of us.
And so began the triumphant journey of Autonama. With help from a professional coach, the team took second place in Italy. And that was just the first trip of many, says Florian Werner.
To Brazil, to Israel, to Saudi Arabia, to England, to Oslo, to Paris, to Cyprus. These last three places just in this year alone.
Werner says he's proud to represent Germany, even if the team is better at wordplay than actual gameplay. In between tournaments, the team has published 3 collections of fiction and nonfiction. Right now, Autonama is a men's team, but the players do hope a women's team will get started in the future. Wolfram Eilenberger, the philosopher, says that might require a change in German soccer culture. There's still a stereotype here that soccer fans are mostly men, and mostly rowdy hooligans. For that reason, Autonama often visits schools, in hopes of inspiring the next generation of writers and philosophers.
You don't have to choose between literature and sports, because a lot of young boys think, you know, either I read and I'm a nerd, or I play soccer and I'm a sports guy. And I think what we embody as a team, and that's important to me also, looking back at my personal history, that it might be a better and richer life if you just choose both.
For The World, Daniel Gross, Berlin.
Coming up, cartoonist Lalo Alcaraz takes the direct approach to satire in the Trump era on The World. The Women's March on Washington wasn't just an American phenomenon. Many cities across the globe joined in similar protests. For example, there was one in Cape Town, South Africa, and Mitali Jain was one of the organizers. She's an American living in Cape Town, so we called her up to see how it went.
We had a turnout ranging anywhere between 800 and 1,000, depending on who you ask.
Did it feel like there was a lot at stake for it being a success?
Absolutely. I mean, in contrast to other marches that I think where the measure of success is often, you know, whether you're able to influence the participants and the decision makers locally, I think an additional objective here was to be seen internationally and to be seen to be standing in solidarity with, you know, with sisters in the U.S. and elsewhere.
Did it feel like a success?
It did. I mean, I think we were really astounded at the turnout that we received. And I think also we were able to put together our own manifesto, very similar to the vision and unity principles that the Sister March in Washington put together. And so in that sense, I think we were able to adapt the march so that it wasn't just U.S. expats in South Africa, you know, showing solidarity with, you know, our sisters and brothers there, but also it was a platform for people here in South Africa who share many of the struggles towards women's rights and gender equality to use the platform to voice their concerns about similar violations that are occurring here at the behest of those in power.
What are some of the struggles in South Africa that women there would claim as their own?
Well, I mean, I think many of the struggles that were articulated in the principles by the DC women organizers are true here. But I think one in particular that the Cape Town organizers wanted to stress was the scourge of violence against women. The numbers globally of South Africa and violence against women statistics is just alarming. And so they wanted to, you know, really highlight the lack of human security, the lack of freedom from violation to bodily integrity that exists here in South Africa. The other, I think, thing that was unique, not just for South African women, but also for women living abroad, that wasn't really contemplated, let's say, by the organizers of the DC march, is that Trump's foreign policies and potentially restrictions on foreign aid that the U.S. Provides could have some dire implications for women living in the rest of the world, particularly in the developing world.
Give me a specific example of how that foreign aid might impact those women.
Well, certainly in respect to PEPFAR funding, you know, funding for people living with HIV, there's been some talk about particular restrictions and particular advances that were made prior to Trump coming in that could be rolled back or eliminated.
So, Mitali, as an American in South Africa, did marching in a South African city draw you closer to South African women, you think, and their struggles? Did some solidarity result from this for you personally?
Absolutely. And not just the march itself, but I think that the whole process of organizing the march confirmed for me the solidarity that exists between women here and women in the U.S. Indeed, the program before the march was a beautiful mix of speakers and performers connecting the struggles between South Africa and the United States.
Mitali Jain, one of the organizers of the Women's March in Cape Town, South Africa. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Marco.
Finally today, Chicano political cartoonist and satirist Lalo Alcaraz. He's a force behind La Cucaracha. It's a nationally syndicated political comic strip that tackles Latino themes, things like deportation, walls, taco trucks, and of course, Trump. Lalo Alcaraz dropped by our Boston studios earlier today. My colleague on the satire desk, Carol Hills, had some questions for him.
Lalo, your satire is direct and tough. An example is after President Trump was elected, one of your cartoons said simply, "If you're brown, double down."
Yeah, that's my new slogan for life.
Why do you take such a direct approach?
I don't know any other way. I mean, images pop into my head. I believe that editorial cartooning, the number one goal is to be direct and clear. And so as long as you have that and you can kind of half draw a stick figure, I mean, as long as the meaning is there, I think you're a successful communicator. And that's what, you know, in this time of alternate facts and reality, we have to be blunt with the truth and show it. So,
But what about the other aspect of where we are now with satire, which is we're in a very divided country. Many, many people unhappy about President Trump. Millions of others voted for him. Do you feel that your approach to cartoons and satire is preaching to the choir?
Well, I don't know if I'm preaching to the choir. I think I'm a banner for the choir to hold into battle. You know, I'm like making, you know, messages and also allowing people to discuss these issues with a better grasp. I hope. If you disagree with me, maybe that's the pain that you feel, is the pain of facts and critical thinking happening in your brain. And I also want to put out a message that, you know, we should also laugh in these very hard times. And that's something that my Mexican parents taught me. It's kind of the Mexican national pastime. I was just telling my Uber driver, you know, that the U.S. has become Mexico. That's why we all have 10 jobs. And maybe we've entered that kind of bad hombre dictatorship era also, you know, that's a hallmark of Latin American countries.
But do you also feel any compulsion to try to bridge the divide? Do you feel like you want to expand your audience to those people who voted for Trump for whatever reason?
You know, what's funny is during the fall, right in the heat of the election, some Trump voters did reach out to me in very negative ways, which is, you know, par for the course. I get a lot of hate mail. A guy on Twitter, he direct messaged me and told me he couldn't wait for me to be deported. I'm like, I'm a U.S. citizen and you're a 37-year-old white guy from Ohio, but I'm 52. So I've been here in this country longer than you have. Curiously, the guy after Trump won, he didn't apologize, but he said, "I'm going to take the higher road and I'm going to, you know, I guess stop saying hateful things to you." But I think there is a little crack in the door where we can have dialogue, but not when it's when my rights are meant to be snuffed out.
Do you ever feel like you're overdoing identity politics? That's often a criticism of the left or progressives.
Yes and no. I grew up not seeing myself in the media, and I think that that's why I became someone that makes images of Latinos on TV and in my cartoons. So I just think it's important. And I have little brown kids. Well, they're not so little anymore, but you know, I want them to feel okay about themselves and not believe the nasty propaganda.
Lalo Alcaraz is a political cartoonist, a radio satirist. He writes for TV. He does it all. Lalo, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much. I love the world.
After Carol spoke with Lalo, he joined us for a Facebook Live session. You can watch him sketch his take of Donald Trump. We still got the video posted on our Facebook page. Just look for PRI's The World. And that'll wrap things up from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.